The Theosophical Society in America presents Joy Mills, The Important Principles of the Secret Doctrine.
The study of the secret doctrine has absorbed me for many, many years. And interestingly enough, I'm looking back in some records and discovered that I conducted the first class in the secret doctrine. The first class that I conducted in the secret doctrine was here in Wheaton, in 1943. So that is a little while ago. And I have carried on a love affair with these volumes ever since. I feel that the study of these volumes exposes one to a particularly virulent theosophical virus. It is really one for which there is no known cure. I haven't taken this up with Dora in her health workshops, but so far as I know, there is no known cure once you have contracted the virus. And so here I am 43 years later, still talking about the secret doctrine. That does not mean at all that I am by any means an expert in it or in all that is in it, but that I think there is so much to probe in it that one can spend, indeed, a full lifetime exploring these really wonderful volumes. It's true that whatever one studies, one finds that there is a textbook on the subject. If you're going to go to university and take up any topic at all, there is a textbook on that subject. Now, that doesn't always mean that the textbook is the final authority, but it does mean that as a text, it sets forth principles that are basic to the study of whatever the subject may be. Those principles become, in effect, the basis for any further study in that particular field. It's true you may return to the textbook again and again to renew the principles or to see how they may be applied in different ways. Now, in the study of the theosophical philosophy, the theosophical worldview, the essential principles of this esoteric tradition, wisdom, religion, whatever you wish to call it, are set forth very clearly, although you may not think it is so clear, but really quite clearly, in the secret doctrine. Not, therefore, in some final sense of revelation, or in some sense as the ultimate and absolute authority, but rather set forth as you would find the principles, for example, in a textbook on chemistry or physics or any other field that you might take up, as testable, verifiable principles which can be put to work. I want to make this very clear because very often even members say, are you assuming then that the secret doctrine is the final authority? And I'm trying to make very clear that this is not in that sense a work of final authority, but it is a textbook in the same sense as a college text in any other subject. Furthermore, any one of us, any student of the theosophical worldview, could, given ample time and opportunity, collect information from all the world's religions, scriptures, mythologies, cultures, and so on, and from all of this, deduce certain fundamental principles, essentials that can be found in all of the scriptures, philosophies, cultural backgrounds of the world from prehistory to the present. So these volumes, and this I'm emphasizing again, are to be viewed neither as revelation nor as the final statement of truth, unalterable for all time. There is still much work for the earnest student to do. And we are told, indeed, that only a few of the basic principles of this esoteric tradition have been set forth. There is much to do, both, therefore, in uncovering these basic principles that are embedded in the doctrine as it's presented, and there is far more to do, of course, in testing their validity. Because while the physicist or the chemist or the scientist in the hard sciences may take the principles into the laboratory and test them, in this instance, the laboratory is our own lives, our own nature. And that is the only place where they are testable and verifiable. And consequently, H.P. Blavatsky makes it very, very clear that these principles that she is enunciating here, some of them, only some, she says, of the whole range of the occult philosophy, have been verified again and again by sages and seers through the ages who were willing to make the effort to verify them. Now, that's the important thing. Quite obviously, if one wants to become a physicist, one has to engage in a certain effort. And for some, it's more of an effort than for others. For me, it would be a tremendous effort because I am not by nature a scientist. I'm quite willing to move into other fields. But for some, you see, it depends on your own inclination. So an effort has to be made. And yet they are verifiable. They are testable. And ultimately, really, must be applied to our lives to understand their deeper and deeper meanings. That in every situation, in every circumstance in which we may be placed, these principles can be applied. Now, most fundamental, of course, to the entire theosophical worldview, therefore, are three propositions which are set forth at the very outset of the secret doctrine. These are so not simply because HPB says they are fundamental, mind you, but simply because any examination of the roots of this wisdom tradition in either Eastern literature or Western literature will lead one precisely to these three fundamental propositions. So again, it's not because someone, H.P. Blavatsky, says they are fundamental. It's because you can discover them for yourself. But, you know, it's nice to have a textbook available, isn't it? You see, if you went to university and you decided you were going to take up, let us say, the study of chemistry, and the professor came in and said, well, I'm sorry, we have no textbooks, we have no place to start, we do have some beakers and Bunsen burners and chemicals in the laboratory there, and you go in and you just figure out what to do, you know. We'd really very soon either blow up the university or drop out. Isn't this true? Do you see the analogy? And so I'm trying to make this very clear because I don't want us to think, at least I do not approach this, that this is in some way an unalterable authority. It is a guideline. It's relatively easy to describe what is in the secret doctrine. Actually, anyone can take the volumes and look at the table of contents and more or less appreciate what is contained in them. If we were to spend time to describe the authorship of the secret doctrine, that would become a more difficult task. Therefore, I am not intending to do it. There is not time this weekend, nor is that our principal purpose, since we're looking at principles. But it is a fascinating study, this whole matter of authorship. Now, as a whole, the secret doctrine expounds the essential nature and cosmic origin of the universe and humanity. It places us in the total process. It gives us our situation, if you like. It does so by presenting us first with universals of the process, and then next by pointing out the unique position that is occupied by our humanity, our present humanity. So it supplies then what we may call the metaphysics of theosophy. And it describes then the principles and the sequences by which the periodical, perishable, phenomenal universe came to be. Where we are, because this is where we are, from and within the deathless, unmanifested, noumenal reality. Consequently, it presents us at once with a metaphysic that is non-dual, not monistic, but non-dual. There's a subtle difference, and we'll look at this more particularly tomorrow. Now, consequently, this whole purpose governs the method by which the secret doctrine is written, governs the method of its writing. And these provide the directive to the student. That is, we have to read it in the spirit in which it was written, if you like, in the spirit of the work itself. And we can't hope to get very far unless we enter into it. In this, it's different from many other works, all other works, I suggest. Because to understand simply a rational, orderly, manifested universe is not the final object. The ultimate intent is that we understand our position in a phenomenal universe and consequently our responsibility and the work that we are to undertake. Now that is quite a different purpose, isn't it? In other words, we are not simply to be witnesses of a process. We are to be participants in the process. But to be participants, we have to know what the process is. You see the difference. And it is a very marked difference, and one that I think isn't always appreciated in approaching the secret doctrine, because we would like to approach it as we would approach any other textbook, any other book, in fact, where we are simply the observer, the witness. But here we are involved. We are asked to become participants in the process. Now, because this is so, every time you pick up the secret doctrine or study it, and there are many ways of studying it, and I'll talk about some of those in due time. Anytime you pick it up, you are going to inevitably come to a different understanding of it. Why? Because you are different. You bring yourself each time to it. And so while the principles may be there, what is underlying those is the fact that there is a process going on. Now, two immediate problems, therefore, which are really problems in our Western thinking, confront us, and they have to be faced. They have to be very squarely faced. First, we in the West particularly, our whole attention in Western thought has been given to objective phenomena. And it's only recently, with the developments in what we call modern physics, or the new physics, or contemporary physics, that we are having to change our point of view, isn't it? It's only relatively within the last decade even, it seems to me, that this has come up more and more. And there is still resistance to this in any educational methods that I know of in our schools today. We have grown up, all of us, in a tradition in which we are accustomed to consider everything outside us as objective. And therefore, we have become incapable of analyzing subjective movements and recognizing that everything, everything, which is one thing, says HPB, is subjective. It is all rooted in manifesting, revealing consciousness. Now, this is a terrific shift in thinking. It may become easier for future generations if the new physics has its ramifications in the methodology of education, which it hasn't yet, at least so far as I can see. But it makes a tremendous difference, doesn't it? There is, in other words, no thing, nothing outside you. Not chairs, not tables, not glasses of water, not papers, nothing. Not people. Now, this is another way of looking at it. Your very observation, this is what, for example, Dr. John Wheeler is saying, your very observation is bringing about a change in the universe. That's why Wheeler has called it a participatory universe. This is a marvelous phrase. HPB didn't use that term, but she well might have used it. She wrote, quite naturally, in the language of her time. She wrote in the language of 100 years ago. But she might just as well have said it. And in that sense, the secret doctrine, the centenary of whose publication we will be celebrating in just 2 years, you know, is really the most contemporary of all theosophical literature, in my estimation. I make a flat statement. It is the most contemporary of our literature because it pointed to this fact 100 years ago. Quite amazing. Now, that's the first problem. As a consequence of that is the second problem, that we have learned to define categories to such an extent that we assign thingness to process. This is our difficulty. And it's not easy because words, by their very nature, assign static thingness. The moment I say chair, I have made it a thing. But that is our language, do you see? Isn't it? So we have assigned thingness to process. And we are so accustomed to this that we have forgotten that there is nothing as such things as things. I don't know how to say it. There are no such things as things. There are only processes in which we participate. Now, we have to use language, of course. But to overcome these particular problems, the secret doctrine employs a method of exposition which is characteristic of all genuine occult or esoteric texts. It's known in the East, in India, for example, as the sutra method. The term sutra simply being thread. That's all it means. But what it is the use of an aphoristic text with commentaries thereon. And the secret doctrine, therefore, is based on aphoristic texts, which are designed to awaken a consciousness of process. This is why sometimes the wording seems very strange to us. It seems very confusing, very difficult, because it is twisting the normal mental process to which we're accustomed. And we want to pin things down. We are great collectors of butterflies, pinning everything to cardboard, you know, and exhibiting them. So that what we are accustomed to doing is collecting facts which we can pin on the board of our minds, memories, wherever, you see, and bring them up out of the file drawers or wherever you have them at the appropriate moment. And hopefully nothing will have changed. The trouble is, everything will have changed, you see. Am I making this clear? Is this, you see? Because this is really the basis. Now, it really doesn't matter, therefore, where these stanzas came from. This is irrelevant. Now, there are those who have been doing some research who have looked into this, and there are various places in the secret doctrine where the books of cute are referred to, and the whole what are known as the Lamrim texts, which are indeed texts in Tibetan Buddhism. But, you see, no scholar has so far discovered where these stanzas of Jian. There is no historical evidence of their existence. Now, that doesn't mean there may not come some historical evidence. And in fact, we have a member in Oregon, David Riegel, who has suggested that this is now traceable to certain Tibetan texts within the whole Lamrim category. I think they will be eventually brought up, but it doesn't matter. The point is, this very term, dhyan, comes, of course, from, it's the same word, the same cognate as dhyana, which is same as jnana, or knowing. They are, in other words, statements, insofar as statements could be made, of genuine knowing, not of thinking, not of guessing, not of opinion, but of knowing. Knowing how? Knowing through profound meditation. Profound meditation. This, of course, is the whole basis of the Vedas. The whole Rig Veda is the result of the profound interior contemplation through tapas, through concentration which produces an interior heat. So if you get overheated in studying the secret doctrine, it's perfectly all right. Dora will see that the furnaces are turned off and you can warm your own rooms. It's very simple that way. If you could do it, you would bring forth these great statements, do you see? But it really is irrelevant because the method of exposition is indeed designed to awaken, ultimately, this knowing. Now, how do we do it? The message which is embedded in this method of exposition is a very strange one for Western ears, Western minds, Western rational thought processes. But it's very clear, and HPB makes the statement, it's embedded in the secret doctrine, live the life if you would come to the wisdom. That's the whole basis. Do you see? I've already said that in essence, haven't I? These are verifiable, testable. And she makes this very clear statement. You may say, well, you're using her as an authority. I'm merely saying that this is the whole technique for this kind of study of the wisdom religion, the esoteric philosophy, the theosophical worldview. Live the life if you would come to the wisdom. Now that's where it's difficult. You may know a great deal about, in other words, about these principles. You may utilize them and so on. But it is only as one gears one's life. Now that again is process, isn't it? Do you see? That's process. And that's why every time you return to the secret doctrine, it says something new to you. Because your life, your experience, your own development has taken place. You are not the same that you were yesterday. And I hope none of you will be the same. Well, you couldn't be, but anyway, none of you will be the same when you leave this after this weekend. I hope you will all be transformed. You can write your own secret doctrine then. Isn't that marvelous? But this is precisely what makes the doctrine secret. This is why the very title. This is what makes the doctrine secret. Because its secrecy is in that unfolding life which is your own. It is not expressible, alterable, and so on. So as a result of this method of exposition, the secret doctrine maintains its intrinsic vitality. And that is why, a century later, it is still not only a classic of theosophical thought, but is very much a bestseller in many regards. It may not be our bestseller, but figuratively speaking, it is still the most remarkable work that has been produced, certainly in centuries. Really an amazing work. And incredible that it should be written in English. Have you ever thought of that? You know. Amazing. By a Russian, coming through a Russian woman who, and when I say coming through, I don't mean that she was some kind of amanuensis, a medium, but rather that she was a mediator for a knowledge, for an understanding, written by a Russian woman who spoke French fluently because she was of the aristocracy of Russia, and yet did not write it in either Russian or French. Aren't we fortunate? I think we are, at least. She wrote it in English. And so with it has this vitality. Every time you return to it, you can gain some new insight. So with these considerations in mind, let me suggest a few points that may be important. So therefore, the secret doctrine is not a narrative nor a description. It is a peculiar exposition. Hence, it cannot be understood simply by reading it through as one would an ordinary book. I realize that this is frequently what happens. When I used to live here and work here at Olcott, I recall incidents in our Olcott library where some borrower would, of course, take out the secret doctrine and at the conclusion of a month return it and say, what do I read next? You know, and so on. This may still be going on, I don't know, but it's not that kind of work. Now, it may be helpful to read it through, and I think this can be extremely useful, but there are many, many ways of approaching it. It is helpful sometimes to simply read it through, a sequential reading. The problem is that the true subject of the work, the real subject, as I've already pointed out, is something which changes. It does not change in the sense that it depends upon us to participate in it because it's process, and the process does not change. The work, therefore, need have no sequence. It does not need to have a sequence. Do you see why? It does have, of course, is because the knowable universe, the phenomenal universe, displays a complex physical and superphysical structure. And we like to have sequence, you see. And we say, well, all about us there is sequence. You started as a baby, you grew into a child, into a teenager, a young adult, and so on, you see. This is the course. The seven stages of man's existence, as Shakespeare put it, and so on, you see. Isn't that right? So we like sequence, and we are accustomed to sequence. But here, the work really need not have a sequence, which is why you can open it anywhere and begin. And go in both directions, if you wish, you see. Sort of like Don Quixote who leapt on his horse and went off in all directions at once, you see. You can do that with it. But that it does have a sequence is because there is a display before us in the phenomenal universe of a complex physical and superphysical structure. We'll be talking about that tomorrow night when we talk about the process of exteriorization, as I call it. Nice fancy word. I didn't know what else to call it, so I called it exteriorization. If I could have thought of a simpler word, I would have used it, but it's a good enough word. All right. Interestingly enough, and this you must keep in mind, the secret doctrine, as I've already said, was written a century ago, lacking 2 years, so we'll say a century ago. But the science on which it draws for its proof, so far as a scientific philosophy is concerned, has been emerging only in this century. Hence, some knowledge of the current state in the physical and life sciences is useful. Is useful, not necessary, but useful. It's helpful. And fortunately today, that knowledge is very much available to the layman in quite readable books, beginning, I suppose, with Capra's Tao of Physics, but many, many others that have come along since then, many, many others that are of value. And so it is useful to have some familiarity. Now, the statements that HPB makes in The Secret Doctrine are drawn from all cultures with a kind of sublime and assured impartiality. Consequently, some acquaintance with the greatest of the past societies is useful. And I think as one becomes more and more familiar with these various traditions, these various cultural traditions, these past societies, the more one has of access to, then, the way in which these principles have expressed themselves. This has been, to me, one of the great and marvelous things of my own theosophical career, is traveling all over the world, as many of you know, and coming in contact with cultures of the present and many of the past, to have some access to it. Now, culture, in the sense of The Secret Doctrine, is not physical artifacts. Remember that. Such as pyramids and paintings and poetry and so on. These are only the outer signs of inner human transformations. So there's a physical cultural process associated with a corresponding method of understanding. For example, to really appreciate the Chaldean civilization, one has to understand what was the Chaldean mode of thought that led to the developments in astrology and astronomy. And this is rather interesting, because it's helpful to come into contact with the modes of thought. Let me just refer you to one instance again. One of our own members of the Theosophical Society, someone I know that Dora knew very well, and I only barely met before his death, Benjamin Whorf. He wrote a most remarkable work, which has been a standard work in schools and colleges, on language, thought, and reality. It's a wonderful work. I think it's out of print now, but surely we have a copy in the library. And it's a marvelous work. And his contribution was along the line of recognizing that, for example, in the North American Indian languages, in many of the North American Indian languages, the a matter of verbal tense, past, present, and future, was not existent. And this, therefore, reflected a consciousness in which everything was present now. Totally present. Now, this has a great effect, therefore, on the culture. There are, and this has been brought out by Dr. Marie-Louise von Franz, one of the great Jungian scholars, there are North American Indian groups who do not count by 1, 2, 3, 4, for example, but rather that 2 is the two-ness of one. 3 is the threeness of one. There is only one. And all numbers are but the recognition of the multiplicity of the one. Now imagine that kind of consciousness, you see. So that language does reflect the culture of the time. And so this one has to understand. Consequently, HPB drew on all of these cultures with, as I say, a kind of sublime impartiality. And you get all of it thrown in, and you may feel that it stands in your way at times, you see. And yet, it helps you. For example, she draws very, very much on the Puranas, particularly the Vishnu Purana. And this introduces you to ways of thinking, to a whole mode of thinking that is different from that in which most of us have been raised, do you see? So that is important. So the doctrine then is unlocked often by means of keys developed or perceived through correspondences between cultures and their expressions in terms of the thought process, the metaphysics or psychology of the cultures, if you like. Now, the secret doctrine further declares that the origins of the universe are inscrutable, and the nature of the real is therefore to be experienced only after evolution is complete. The nature of the real is experienceable. This, of course, is very much found in the Upanishads. It's very much found in the commentaries of Shankaracharya, particularly the great work of Advaita Vedanta, Viveka Chudanami. This is, in other words, the possibility, and that is why all of our knowings will be partial. It cannot, in other words, be merely intellectualized. Since reality is living, it is blissful, it is both infinite and non-infinite, eternal and non-eternal, impersonal and personal, all of this, but it implies that the nature of the real can, however, be judged in anticipation of experience through the phenomenal universe. Therefore, the importance of the phenomenal universe. Any aspect of the phenomenal becomes an aperture to the real. This you will find very much in the second quotation, which you're going to be reading before 9:30 tomorrow morning, which I've simply called Minor and Gold. But it's there, you see. We inhere in the noumenal. Therefore, we do not know it, we ultimately experience it. But we know it by its reflection in the phenomenal. Again, a process, you see. Now, we can realize this in two ways, both of them are required, self-scrutiny and self-mastery. But such understanding is possible only if it's realized, and we'll be talking more about this, that the phenomenal world is not made out of substance, but out of principles, which of course have been called elements. That is, the apparent matter of experience is not space-filling. It's instead an aggregate of points and essences of spiritual consciousness. And that's all that any one of us is. A point which is dimensionless, a point of spiritual consciousness. The world, in short, is made out of consciousness and only behaves as if it were material. So what do? We look at its behavior. So the work declares, therefore, that, as I've already said, the greatest truths have always been knowable, have always been accessible from the time that man landed on this planet. They have been taught for millennia. And it follows, therefore, that understanding means insight conjoined with self-disciplined right conduct. Now, since the doctrine has always been known, it occurs, therefore, in all cultures, all traditions. But as it's known by way of actual living, not simply by analysis, it follows that, as I've already said, by its own nature, it is necessarily a secret doctrine. And that is, it remains secret because so very few have been willing to make the effort required to come to know it, to possess it, embody it in their own lives. We live what we know. You may say, well, I don't really live up to what I know. You don't live up to what you think you know, but you live what you know. Your life is the evidence of what you really know. If you really know it, you live it, you see. It's in you. So this is what we're presented with. I might add that consequently a certain attitude is required, what is known in Buddhist terminology as a healthy attitude. A healthy attitude. Now, if there's a healthy attitude, health means that there is a clarity, an interior openness, what we may call a purity. The mind is not sullied by all kinds of preconceived ideas. It is not colored, you see. What is the kind of mind, therefore, that we bring to this study? What is this kind of mind? I remember on one occasion some years ago when I was at Adyar, having lunch with our late Krishnamurti, most remarkable person, and it was not anything he had said in any of his talks, but at this particular luncheon, he kept saying, "I would like to know what is the mind of the child." What is the mind of the child? What is it like? And we discussed this. It was rather interesting. There were quite a group there for the luncheon. And I was intrigued by it. I said nothing because I was so intrigued by what he might come to in this exploration, you see. But this is the healthy mind, the mind of the child. Now, this is not easy for us because inevitably we're going to bring to our study everything we think we know, you see. Every idea that's ever occurred to us, all of our background, all of our education, all of our association with other books of theosophy, and so on, you see. But this mind of the child, which Krishnaji was so concerned with, has its own healthiness, its own clarity. It's ready to perceive anything, you see, anything that may arise. And so this is the attitude that is absolutely required